You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Bores. And if you hear a little bit of drilling, it's the economy at work. Today is the big day in the UK and in the US, but we'll first start with the British news. The government is bringing forward its lockdown legislation into the House of Commons. Katie, how's that vote looking? Because we know a lot of backbenchers are not entirely happy.
Yes, lots of backbenchers are unhappy, but we are not expecting much in the way of a huge problem with this vote. One concern when Boris Johnson called the lockdown, or was rushed into calling the lockdown, was that he might have to rely on Labour votes to get it through. At the moment, that seems unlikely because the rebellion of Tory MPs, while it will be something we can see, we don't expect it to be huge. We know that some of the rebels include Graham Brady, chair of the 1922 committee, Charles Walker, vice chair, and also Esther McVeigh, former cabinet minister. And we are expecting, you know, a few more names to join that. But I think it's also notable that quite a lot of Tory MPs who we know to be sceptical of lockdown are going to back the government this time around. I've actually been surprised by the number of Red Wall MPs, so the 29 intake, who sounding fairly supportive of the government on this, to be honest, saying that they do back the government and making the point that some of these figures, such as Graham Brady, while chair of the 1922 committee, don't speak for them completely on this issue. So while the Brady amendment got support a few weeks ago, which was the idea of Parliament having more of a say, they're saying, you know, they do not share that person's views wholesale on lockdown, and quite keen for that point to be made. So I think it will be interesting to see the speeches and so forth, but I think you're looking at potential crunch votes. The extension on the 2nd of December, if we end up going towards an extension, is the one that will be quite interesting to see if more join the fold. I think that if you look at when Boris Johnson made the statement on Monday, not many supportive Tory MPs, lots asking questions. I think the most supportive actually was Bernard Jenkin, saying that he was supporting the Prime Minister on the basis that no one else has suggested anything that seemed like a comprehensive go-to strategy, but also putting pressure on the Prime Minister about test and trace. So I think that even those who are supportive of the Prime Minister, be it reluctantly, want to see changes being made to things like test and trace, all the rollout of mass testing over this 4-week period. So I think that whether it leads to a rebellion, there'll be serious frustration if you get to a point where it potentially has to be extended and the government can't point to what they've done this time.
James, one thing that has caused frustration amongst these backbenchers is the 4,000 deaths a day figure that Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance trotted out on Saturday's press conference. And they were asked about that in a Science Select Committee yesterday, at which point Patrick Vallance pretty much said that he regretted using those sort of graphs. Is that enough to sort of placate the backbenchers?
Yeah, I think Katie's analysis of the mood is right. I think people are grumpy. They're not yet ready to vote against the government. You can say, oh, we keep hearing this from Tory MPs. But, you know, I think if Boris Johnson had to come back to Parliament for a third lockdown, then he really would be stretching their patience. Now, you can say, oh, we keep hearing from them that not next time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the big question is this lockdown is a tactical lockdown to try and protect the capacity of the NHS. And I think MPs reluctantly accept the rationale for that. The big question is, what is the strategy to prevent the need for another lockdown? Now, Boris Johnson is going big on this idea of rapid testing. We're seeing this experiment to try and test the whole city in Liverpool this week. And I think the question is, can that get going fast enough to mean that there doesn't need to be another one? It's worth remembering that when Sage first proposed the idea of a circuit breaker nationwide, in this case it is England-wide lockdown, it admitted in the same document that you would probably need another one later in the winter. I think if there needs to be another one later in the winter, I think that is just another bit of political capital that Boris Johnson will have to expend. So I think the big question is, what is the strategy for avoiding a third England-wide lockdown?
And Katie, one of the issues bubbling in the background is what the furlough scheme means for devolved nations if they want to go further on the restrictions. And there's been a bit of mixed messaging from the government on that. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so this all goes to Boris Johnson's statement. He was asked, I think, by Douglas Ross, but also by a few other figures. Well, look, you've now announced furlough to go with this England-wide lockdown. Does this also mean it's up for grabs for the devolved administrations, whether they're in lockdown or circuit breaker? And Boris Johnson replied by suggesting, you know, of course, you know, we treat all of the United Kingdom as the same. But then shortly after, it didn't seem completely clear from speaking to figures in government and also ministers and subsequent broadcast rounds that actually the 80% furlough scheme was back and open for all. I still think we're waiting for clarity, but I think there is a sense that it is viewed as inevitable, to be honest, that it will be offered to other, you know, devolved administrations, just because I think there is a sense that you can't have it in one part and not the rest. But then you get into this awkward situation, which is who decides the length of which, you know, lockdown restrictions are in place? Because one of the things the Treasury wants to avoid is a situation where ultimately, you know, the Welsh government or the Scottish government could just choose to have, you know, a 2-month lockdown, and that all of a sudden they have to foot the bill for that without any kind of back and forth on it. Because I think when you're looking at how the devolved, you know, approach has worked throughout coronavirus, there is a frustration in Downing Street that you have a situation where all the public health and so forth is down to devolved administrations, but it's ultimately Westminster that has to find the money. And I think this is an example of how that can be exacerbated.
Meanwhile, James, the explosive US election happened overnight, and I'm sure listeners, by the time that you're listening to this podcast, A, things will have changed, and B, you'll all be caught up on the latest. But here's what Donald Trump had to say, in case you haven't heard it, at about 5 a.m. UK time this morning.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop.
Now, James, what's been going on? This is the worst case scenario that we thought might happen, that he would just declare himself the winner.
Yeah, I think the argument is inherently contradictory in that he wants them to carry on counting votes in Arizona. I think Fox News actually points out that he wants them to carry on carrying votes in Arizona, but stop counting votes elsewhere. I think we see part of the reason why is that, as in Michigan and Wisconsin, as the mail-in ballots are added to a total, suddenly Trump's lead gets hugely cut. I think it is worth noting something. This election is closer than the polls expected. I still think, looking at the numbers right now, we are that the most likely outcome of the election is President Biden, not a second term for President Trump. But it's clearly been a disappointing night for the Democrats. I mean, they are now unlikely to take back the Senate. And the margin, this is not the kind of Biden blowout that some people were. I think Dominic Raab was trying to be kind of, should we say, diplomatic about Donald Trump, you know. And I think that the UK government will, Chris Meyer wrote a piece for the former ambassador to Washington, wrote a piece for the magazine about this over the summer. I think the UK government will kind of try and get and stay as far away as possible from getting involved in the US election and saying, look, trust the US process and institutions to work it out. I think where things get much more, potentially much more difficult for the UK government is Joe Biden has a route to victory that does not involve Pennsylvania, a state that is slow to count votes. If it looks like Joe Biden has got to 270 electoral votes without Pennsylvania, Joe Biden declares victory, that, I think, becomes actually a much more difficult moment for the UK government. Because I think you're already seeing that kind of the usual conventions of diplomacy are not being entirely observed. If other states start congratulating Joe Biden, then I think that would put the UK government in a very difficult position. Now, look, we are obviously some way off that point, but I mean, one of the significances, if you think back to Bush versus Gore in 2000, that's the nearest precedent for this. That was one state, Florida, that it turned on. So that was one case to go to the Supreme Court. Here, it could be that the most disputed state, Pennsylvania, it doesn't need that, and it would need kind of multiple court challenges to say that Joe Biden has not reached 270 electoral college votes.
Katie, it's obviously not ideal for the leader of the free world to declare himself continued leader of the free world without the votes having been counted. How difficult is it for the government to walk this line between being diplomatic or not? We saw Dominic Raab, as James mentioned, on the airwaves this morning.
Well, it's tricky, and I also think it's just a reminder of how all the talk that, you know, Downing Street would like Trump to be re-elected and Biden's a huge problem for them. Trump is a complicated candidate that does present problems to number 10, I think partly because they try and do this diplomatic balancing act, but Trump pushes things so much that lots of people will say, well, you know, actually, why don't you just call that out? And I think that yes, you see it in this instance. We've also seen it while Donald Trump's been president. It's interesting, you know, Dominic Raab did the broadcast round where he would not say, you know, whether it's right for Donald Trump to falsely claim victory. But you had Lisa Nandy on, the shadow foreign secretary, quite soon after. And she was saying, oh, you know, well, we actually do think that's wrong. I don't know why Dominic Raab won't say it. So Labour are much more comfortable attacking Donald Trump. And I think that if Donald Trump is, you know, re-elected and... clearly, at the moment, it seems more people think Biden will, but they were saying Biden will get a landslide victory. If that does happen, then I think that it's just another example of how it is this difficult situation for number 10. I don't think Biden is simple and easy either, but it's difficult in different ways. And I think that if you do have Trump going into a second term, again, the UK government is pushed and people like to depict the UK government as taking Donald Trump's side. And actually, it's often they're not saying that they are on his side, but they're not saying they're not. And therefore people join the dots.
James, what do you think is going to happen next?
So I think we kind of wait to see what happens in Georgia. You know, for example, if Joe Biden wins that, and that would make his electoral college map a lot easier. If everything turns on Pennsylvania, things will get very difficult because the Pennsylvania electoral process has already been the subject of court challenges and the like. If there is a way that Joe Biden can get to 270 without Pennsylvania, we might get resolution relatively quickly. One well-informed person I was speaking with this morning thinks that, you know, we could have a result, say, Thursday. You know, it could be quite clear by this time tomorrow that Joe Biden is going to become the next president of the United States. I think the other question is, you know, what does Donald Trump do? And it is worth remembering that one of the uniquenesses of the US system is that, you know, in the British system, the Prime Minister loses the general election. The removal van turns up outside Downing Street and he's gone fairly quickly. Donald Trump will be president until mid-January. And what happens in that period, what does he do, how does he behave, I think is an interesting question. I also think that if the Democrats do not take the Senate, I think that has interesting implications for the world economy. Because I think one thing that will mean is the Republicans will rapidly rediscover their fiscal conservatism in opposition to the president. And therefore, I think any kind of US stimulus package would be smaller than expected. That's going to put more pressure on the Federal Reserve. Monetary policy is going to have to be used much more as a tool of policy. And I think that could be quite significant in terms of, you know, what is going to happen to the global economy as we come in 2021.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And if you'd like to drown your sorrows or celebrate the next president of the United States, what could be better to do that with than with a bottle of Paul Roger, which you would be in for a chance to win if you fill out our podcast survey at spectator.co.uk/podcast survey. So hurry, the offer doesn't last for long. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.